Little Lord called me over after the interview and Webb apologized. "Yo, man, I'm sorry for that night. I was real drunk and fucked up," he said. "I was in the wrong." "All right, no problem," I said. "We good." And that was that. I went over to show Fabulous some love. Back in New York, I got some bad news. A letter from the IRS came to my house saying that I owed over $300,000 in unpaid back taxes that had accumulated from 1996 to 2003. I wanted to blame my accountant, Artie Earp, but it was my own fault. Foolish spending. Ever since we signed with Loud Records and our career took off, I would get checks from publishing, advances, budgets, and all kinds of outlets. $50,000 here, $10,000 there, that I didn't take to our accountant. Instead, I deposited them in my account and cashed them and went on shopping sprees. Cars, jewels, clothes, drugs, alcohol, and partying. Man, that shit caught up with me. For too many years, I made terrible financial decisions. I set up a meeting with the IRS agent to figure out a way to pay it off. The best option was to sell my house and pay the bill for my profit. A lot of that tax bill came from financing my own movie and paying for most of its production in cash instead of checks. I did that because I was getting cheaper prices with cash. But now I was really going to pay for it in the end. Then I found out that Kiki was messing with some dudes behind my back. I was devastated, crying like a little punk when I found the emails in her phone and she confessed to me. I never cried over a female before. I felt like a chump. I had the wrong attitude about our relationship. I was hardly ever home, hardly ever called, and acted as if the material possessions I gave her were enough to overlook those shortcomings. I felt like a certified loser. "You know you just made me worse now," I said out of humiliation. "You think I was a cold-hearted motherfucker before? Now you're gonna see cold." I couldn't help it. That's how I really felt. I had no right to be upset. I was out there doing the same thing. Kiki apologized, and I knew in my heart and mind that she wasn't going anywhere. I knew the rules in the game of love very well. Kiki used to tell me, "You know that whatever you're out there doing, remember I'm doing the same thing." "What do you mean by that?" I asked, knowing damn well what she meant. "If you're being faithful, then I'm doing the same thing," Kiki said. "If you're cheating, then I'm cheating." Being the revenge-driven, selfish asshole that I was in our relationship, I got my vengeance by doing more of the foolishness that brought her to cheating in the first place. I was a dumbass jerk with a lot to learn. We sold the house and made a decent profit. 80% of the money went to the IRS, so we didn't have enough to buy a new house. We rented a two-bedroom apartment from Kiki's aunt in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Bridgeport, a poverty-stricken town, was about 2 hours from New York City, and traveling back and forth was stressful, but we had to tough it out until I got my money back in order. Alchemist let me stay at his crib in the city a lot, and whenever I wasn't working, I was with Kiki and the kids. The Bridgeport schools had no money, so the textbooks were old and the teaching was mediocre. I felt horrible about subjecting my family to those conditions. My kids deserved the best, and I promised that we wouldn't live out there for long. Financial problems, relationship problems, and then, to make matters worse, Job dropped Mobb Deep. We knew something was wrong when Job wasn't showing enthusiasm about promoting America's Nightmare any further. The album was almost gold at the time they dropped us, so our selling power was the same. The only thing that being dropped from Job hurt was our pride and ego. But why would we want to be aligned with the company that wasn't excited about us? We were free agents once again. We booked a few shows, rented a tour bus, and set up our studio equipment in the back. Hav didn't want to stop making beats just because we were on the road. On the bus, we had some deep conversations about the music industry and our position in the game. This is crazy, I told Alchemist and Havoc. We've got some of the best music in the industry, and you guys are two of the best producers. We sell nothing but gold or platinum. I don't understand why these company owners don't snatch us up and take full advantage of our power. It definitely feels like niggas is hating on us or something, Havoc said. Eminem, Dr. Dre, and these other niggas need to sign Mobb Deep, I said. We need people that got money that know our worth. I'm tired of hopping from label to label. Headed home from the brief tour a few days later, Alchemist got a phone call from his manager, Paul, who said that Eminem wanted Al to be his official tour DJ. Alchemist was thrilled. DJ Green Lantern, who had been Eminem's DJ since the beginning of M's career, had made a bad move. Jadakiss did a segment on a street DVD called On the Come Up, riding in the back of a car, talking to DJ Green Lantern on a speakerphone. Ever since Ja Rule dissed 50 Cent on New York, featuring Jadakiss and Fat Joe, 50 saw it as disrespectful for Jadakiss and Fat Joe to be a part of Ja Rule's diss record. 50 started taking shots at whoever was on the song. Jadakiss started talking about his new beef with 50.
Yeah, you gotta go in on these niggas, son,
Green Lantern said to Jadakiss, not knowing that Jadakiss was filming the conversation.
Tear the ass up now.
When Eminem and 50 saw the DVD, they fired Green Lantern and hired Alchemist. Now Alchemist was in with the most successful camp in the game. I felt confident that Mobb Deep would be next to get pulled into the winner's circle where the big money was at. Alchemist flew out to Detroit to meet with Eminem and left me with his apartment for a while. Havoc and I set up a meeting with Jimmy Iovine, president of Interscope Records, home to some of the biggest names in hip-hop, including Death Row, Aftermath, Shady, and G-Unit. He was interested in doing a deal with us. We were surprised that we were even on Jimmy's radar and immediately booked a flight to Los Angeles to meet him. Right before we left for Los Angeles, 50 Cent released Piggy Bank, taking shots at Ja Rule, Fat Joe, Jadakiss, and Sean, and he even threw a jab at Mobb Deep. I do your little ass like Jay did Mobb Deep. I was baffled. Damn. Now I gotta deal with this fool, I thought to myself. I like 50 Cent, but I guess this is what my life is gonna be about. Rap beef and street drama. Why did he do that? And then it hit me. Havoc. Havoc's appearance in that faggot-ass Ja Rule video. Then Havoc told me that he was informed that if Londell McMillan represented us, Interscope wouldn't deal with us. Certain labels had bad dealings with Londell in the past, Havoc said. Nah, don't you see these labels and their legal personnel are just hating on Londell because they know he's going to get the best deal possible for us, I said. They can't tell us which lawyer we can and cannot use. But Havoc wanted to fire Londell and hire a new lawyer so we wouldn't ruin our chances of getting signed. That's illegal. You can use any lawyer that you want, Londell told me at a meeting in his office. These label lawyers don't like me because I know how to negotiate. And these companies want to make slaves out of artists. What do you want to do? Sorry, man. I think you're the best there is, but I got to move with my partner. Memphis. These label lawyers don't like me because I know how to negotiate. And these companies want to make slaves out of artists. What do you want to do? Sorry, man. I think you're the best there is, but I got to move with my partner. My nigga Havoc. I felt like choking myself for being so loyal to him sometimes. When Jive dropped us, I was ready to walk away from Mobb Deep for a little while. Fed up and ready for a brand new start. I wanted to establish my own indie label and get a distribution deal. Focus on my solo career until further notice. House money is okay, but I needed Manhattan builder money. I needed great-grandchildren money. A day later, Havoc set up a meeting with an attorney named Theo Suttermeyer, who used to be partners at a firm with Alchemist's manager, Paul Rosenberg. Theo was now 50 Cent and Eminem's lawyer, and I could tell from his words and attitude that in Theo's mind, Mobb Deep was a thing of the past. His assistant brought over retainer agreements for us to sign, giving Theo permission to do business on our behalf. It was painful for me to sign that paper. I felt like I was disrespecting Londell. The vibe that I got from Theo was that he didn't seem genuinely concerned with our career. But Havoc and I had to be on the same page, so to make our lives easier, we moved together on things. We lit cigars as if this was some type of celebration. So, Interscope is showing some interest, Theo said. Yeah, but we'd rather fuck with Eminem. Isn't that your client? I asked. Wouldn't he be interested in signing Mobb Deep? No. Eminem is looking to get away from signing hardcore acts. He wants conscious rap now, like Pharoah Monch and Mos Def. This man actually wanted me to believe that Eminem wouldn't be interested in signing Mobb Deep after what Eminem did for us in his movie. It sounded like bullshit to me. What's up with 50 Cent? Isn't he your client too? I asked. You should get him on the phone and see if he's interested. No. 50 isn't looking to sign anybody right now. He's got too much on his plate already. Let's just see how it goes with Interscope and take it from there. Why would you represent a client who you don't believe in 100%? It seemed like Theo was only in it for the payday and to add another name to his roster. Havoc and I flew to L.A. to meet with Jimmy Iovine at the Interscope office. Those meetings with labels made me sick to my stomach because it felt like I was begging to be signed by executives who had no idea about what's hot in the street. I knew our music was powerful enough for us to be independent. I hated it with every molecule in my body, but tried to be as humble as possible and not show any signs of disgust in my face. I'm a boss, not an employee. Mobb Deep, it's nice to finally meet you guys, Jimmy said after greeting us in his office. I know a lot about your music and history, so you're looking for a new label to call home, huh? Yeah, we seem to outlive all our labels. We're looking for a company that understands our music and audience and can push our albums to the maximum without dropping the ball, I said. I know you guys are veterans. You're like a classic car that just needs a fresh coat of paint, Jimmy said. I wouldn't want to sign you guys directly to Interscope. I'd rather bring you through Aftermath, Shady, or G-Unit, because they know more about how to promote your style of music. So let me run this by Dre and Eminem and see if they're interested. We'll do it like that. That sounds good, Havoc and I agreed. The way Jimmy spoke made me feel more at ease. He seemed genuinely interested and somewhat knowledgeable. Our first pick would be to sign with Dr. Dre. Shady was our second choice, and since 50 just dissed us, we knew he probably wasn't interested. We flew back to New York, and I stayed at Alchemist's apartment for a few days to be alone with my thoughts. Back in Bridgeport, during breakfast with my family, Havoc called. P, where you at? I gotta tell you something, he said, sounding excited. I'm in Connecticut. What's up? You ain't gonna believe this shit. I just got a call from 50. He said he heard that Job dropped us and he's interested in signing us. He wants to have a meeting right away. What? That's crazy. The nigga just tried dissing us on the song and now he wanna sign us? He might be trying to set us up, son, I said. This nigga 50 is trying to make us look stupid or something, I thought. Trying to pull a chess move like Nas. Just come to the studio early tomorrow so we could talk, Hav said. He wants to meet us tomorrow afternoon. June 30th, 2009. Mid-State Correctional Facility. Marcy, New York. 1 a.m. Prison is for losers and dumb fucks. The intelligent winners out in the street with their freedom. Ain't nothing cool or glorifying about being locked up. Whoever thinks this shit gives you street credibility is a fool. All prison does is screw up your life for a short, long, or permanent period of time. My time was short. I don't care if you say you're innocent and got set up, or if you feel your crime was justifiable. You still made some type of mistake, wrong move, did something you shouldn't have done, or went someplace you shouldn't have gone. Basically, you did some dumb shit and got caught slipping. I'm not shitting on inmates. There are plenty of good brothers and sisters trapped in the system. I just want to make it very clear, especially for young kids, that prison is nothing to be proud of. I've been to 5 different facilities during my bid. Rikers Island, 1 month. Downstate, 2 months. Governor, 1 month. Oneida, a few days. And my final stop on my New York State prison tour, Mid-State Correctional Facility, 2 years and 8 months. Inmates and COs from all over New York, from old-timers to young bloods, showed me and Mobb Deep crazy love. It gave me a crazy boost of inspiration. I'd never been away from the studio for so long in my life. I ordered a few instrumental mixtapes from the prison catalog to write songs to, but I can't write to the best of my ability to another artist's music. I needed original, never heard before production from my home team to write hits. It was like trying to get a Muslim to eat pork, getting a beat cassette in Mid-State. They allow only screwless cassettes, shrink-wrapped in plastic, with the invoice from a music distributor. First, I had to order screwless mixtapes or albums from the prison catalog, which only mailed goods to jails. Kiki sent Alchemist the cassettes to record over. Then, Alchemist sent them back to Kiki, who mailed them to my HNIC Part 2 distributor to be shrink-wrapped and shipped with an invoice. It took about 6 months to get a beat tape in my hands. When I finally got my beats, I turned into a songwriting tsunami in that 8x10 steel box. All my producer homeboys started sending me hot shit. Alchemist, Havoc, Sid Roams, SC, and my dude Stevie J, who used to produce for Bad Boy. I wrote 7 albums with those first few cassettes. I gave thanks to the Most High for blessing me with that amount of creativity. I didn't mark notches on my walls for every day they went by, like they did in them jail movies. I never paid the calendar any attention at all. Watching the days made them seem slower. I went without knowing the date or trying to find out. Then the next thing I knew, 3 months would fly by. Letters were coming in from all over the world. Serbia, Russia, England, France, Germany, Hong Kong, and all around the U.S. But the letter I wanted and waited for most never came. Havoc's letter. I'd written Havoc 2 from Downstate, once from Governor, then once from Mid-State. He hadn't responded. Hav never even contacted Kiki to check on my family. Kiki emailed, texted, and called Hav on my behalf on several occasions, and he responded 2 out of 20 tries. Stop reaching out to him if he doesn't want to respond, Kiki said. Maybe he's trying to tell you something. Maybe he doesn't want to do Mobb Deep anymore. No, keep trying, I insisted. That's my partner. If he doesn't want to be my friend, we still got to handle our business. If you come home and you still dealing with dudes like that who don't give a fuck about you, then I'm not fucking with you no more, Kiki said. My man Tyson from Queens started making the 4-hour drive from Jamaica in his messed up hoopty to see me. I would ask him about Havoc, but Tyson said he didn't know what was up with him. I told Tyson to put Havoc in the car and just bring him. I'm going to put him in the car and tell him we're going to the liquor store, Tyson said. Then come straight to you. That sounded funny, but this wasn't a joke. My partner wasn't communicating with me, and there were things we needed to discuss. Even though I was locked up, There was still plenty of ways to keep our money coming. But without communication, it just doesn't work. I wasn't concerned only with business. I was concerned with Hab's well-being. He was more than just a music partner. He was my friend. If there's one thing you learn from prison, it's patience. So I decided to be patient with Havoc. He'll come around eventually. I needed to focus on my number one priority, me. I wanted to build a powerful vocabulary. Besides Dr. York's books, the only books I ever read in my life were the autobiography of Malcolm X and Who Moved My Cheese. I was missing out on a world full of literature, and put it in my mind that I would be like a Tibetan monk locked up in the mountains for 3 years of study and research. By the time I was released, I would come home a mastermind. I started receiving books in the mail from Kiki and my friend Laura Checkaway, who was also the editor of this autobiography. Laura sent me some random books that she thought I would be interested in, and she was 200% correct with her choices. She sent Target Zero, A Life in Writing, the autobiography of Eldridge Cleaver, one of the most infamous Black Panthers. I tore through the book in a week. She also sent Medical Apartheid by Harriet A. Washington, an incredible book about the history of medical experiments on Black people. My wife sent Assata Shakur's autobiography. Foxy Brown told me she read it right before she went home from her bed on Rikers. Assata Shakur was also a Black Panther, and her story was amazing. I also read Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. Not only did reading build my vocabulary, it also allowed me to see life from different points of view. It made me more enthused about life, love, family, God, and my career. It's funny how the right book can do that to you. I see it like this. Knowledge is food for the brain. You could fill up on junk food, fiction, that will cloud your brain with all kinds of pollution. Or you could fill up on health food, facts, that will turn your brain into a strong, intelligent muscle. When I spoke to friends and family over the phone and during visits, they all told me that they could see in my eyes and hear in my voice that I had a fresh new energy. I was taken away from my family and recording studio, the two things I love. It gave me a brand new appreciation for them. It's true when they say that you don't know what you've got until it's gone. There were four inmates I was cool with in my dorm. Young, from Poughkeepsie, Alex, from Hunts Point in the Bronx, Legs Diamond, from the Bronx, and Brandon, from South Jamaica, Queens. Whenever we hung out in the day room and watched shows like 106 and Park, MTV and VH1 videos, and music award shows, I'd get frustrated watching all the artists performing and promoting their new product. It inspired me and made me fiend for the studio like a dope addict. Whenever I got that frustrated feeling, I tell my boys, "Alright, I'm out. I'm going to the studio." And they knew that meant I was locking in my cell to write songs with my Walkman. Chapter 12. Blood money. Now, homie, if I go to hell when you make it to the pearly gates, tell that nigga God we got beef, and tell that nigga Jesus I'ma see him when I see him, and when I see him, I'ma beat him like the movie for leaving us out to dry in straight poverty, for not showing me no signs he watching over me. Pearly gates. Twelve noon, Harlem. Riding up the West Side Highway in the backseat of Havoc's black 2005 4.6 Range Rover with black rims, aka the Black Jelly Bean, I was extremely anxious to see how this monumental meeting was going to turn out. 50 was having a Reebok photo shoot underneath the trestle on 125th Street and the West Side Highway. I had a gun on my waist, as always. But when we pulled up to the spot, I left it in the car. I didn't know if I could trust 50 after he took that shot at us on Piggy Bank, but I decided to give him my trust. So I put the 16 shooter under the car mat and stepped out of the truck. Chris Lighty, our former manager who we parted ways with shortly after the job deal, greeted Havoc Flying Me with his devilish baby face grin, then walked into a trailer. 50 came from the back of the trailer and got right down to business. He told us the amount of respect he had for us, saying that he was our biggest fan and that Mobb Deep motivated him to be a rapper. He gave us all kinds of compliments and said that he wanted to see us on his level of success, selling multi-million units. It was weird hearing that from someone who sold over 10 million and didn't have to give us the time of day. He said he would send us a deal memo, a rough draft of a contract to start the negotiation process ASAP. Back at the studio, Havoc and I discussed the offer for hours. It felt like we hit the lottery, like a miracle. Now we could relax and create dope music without stressing money or label problems, just as Havoc wanted. I could move my family out of Bridgeport. Finally, somebody with power recognized our power. We were going to need a new lawyer because Steele would be a conflict of interest since he represented 50. And he said 50 wouldn't be interested. I told Havoc that we should ask for $2 million to sign. I wasn't expecting $2 million, but when you do business, you start high and the number works its way down. Havoc didn't understand that concept. He thought asking for that much would turn 50 off and we'd lose the deal. But I believed if 50 was serious about all the things he told us, then he should pay the price. He know how ill we are and how much we worth. Driving to Connecticut to chill with Kiki and the kids that night, all kind of thoughts were running through my head about my next move. I was wrapping up HNIC Part 2 and planning to release it independently under my own label. But that call from 50 might change my plan if it all went well. Since the job deal soured, I wanted to stop doing Mobb Deep for a little while and start focusing on Prodigy. I was beginning to see very clearly that Havoc and I were completely different. I knew it all along, but reality was hitting harder than ever. To tell you the truth, I didn't want to do the deal with 50. I felt as though I wasn't being a man by doing the deal. That's why I wanted so much money to sell him a few Mobb Deep albums. The following morning, I told Kiki the news, but she never got excited about anything related to rap music. So 50 didn't mean shit to her. She just wanted to get the hell out of Connecticut. I wrote down the pros and cons of the deal. When I did the math, it made more sense to do it. I emailed 50's lawyer, Theo, saying that it was nice meeting with 50, and we were excited to do business, but that we needed an advance of $2 million upon signing. I CC'd Havoc and 50's assistant Pretty Shy, so they all got the message at the same time. Havoc immediately hit me back with an email barking on me for sending the message. He called me foolish and said he was tired of my antics. He's mad because I'm trying to get us paid? Kiki and I just laughed at his angry emails. Pretty Shy hit me back and said he would get the message to 50. I was talking about the new deal while smoking with Alchemist at his apartment later that day when 50 called asking for my email address to send a song for having me to check out. 20 minutes later, Al and I listened to the first of 30 Mobb Deep featuring 50 Cent track. I burnt it to a CD and rushed back to Queens to link with Hav, excited to show 50 how fast we worked. We knocked it out within an hour. We didn't have internet in our studio in Queens, so I jetted back to Alchemist's crib to send it. That back and forth process became my daily routine for the next 3 weeks. After 3 weeks, we had 30 songs done. 50 called one day while I was at the ATM around the corner from our Queens studio, saying he was impressed by how fast we worked and how good the songs were turning out. Anytime he called, I stopped everything to speak with him. If I was driving, I'd pull a car over to concentrate on our conversation. 50 said he had a surprise that he couldn't hold in, but not to tell Havoc, so at least Hav could be surprised. I'm buying y'all two Porsches as a bonus.